Thank you for downloading this edition of Analysis. For our terms and conditions of use, please go to www.bbc.co.uk/podcasts. In this week's programme, Justin Webb asks, is America doomed?
On my last day in the United States, after 8 years of reporting there for the BBC, 8 years of enormously happy family life in the Washington suburbs, surrounded by sunshine and white picket fences, they held a burger-eating competition at the bottom of our street. Local news anchors in peach-coloured trouser suits interviewed obese, spotty youths before they ran off to be sick. It was revolting, and it brought vividly to my mind the contradictions inherent in modern American life, the strength of character of the nation, its core, which I had witnessed repeatedly in my 8 years, versus the shambolic ghastliness of much of the reality of modern America, the super-sized nation, childish and spoilt. Since I left Washington, one subject in particular has become a focal point of the debate on America's future. It's a subject on the minds of all thoughtful Americans, but it's a subject of huge importance to us as well, because America's ability to grasp this subject, to understand it intellectually and to deal with it in practice, could help shape the way the whole world is governed and led for decades to come. The subject is the debt. $14 trillion of it, growing at $40,000 a second. Like the burger eaters stuffing bread and meat into their mouths, America as a nation is gorging itself on debt. It feels nauseated, but it cannot stop. The economist and author, Diane Coyle.
The debt is an enormous problem. Trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. And there's actually an even bigger problem of government finances. Because on the one hand, you've got the published figures. They reflect the impact of the financial crisis on government finances and an underlying deficit that was there anyway. And then on the other hand, you have the promises implicit in the structure of welfare states and the ageing populations that mean there's an unacknowledged debt that will have to be paid for by future taxpayers as well. And that could actually double the published figures. And this is not just America. This is true of all the advanced Western democracies. But in the case of the states, the figures are absolutely enormous.
America is not in control of its destiny, cannot be in control, while the mountain of debt remains unpaid and has to be serviced, and the politicians can't agree on how to reduce it. The economist Jeffrey Sachs is director of Columbia University's Earth Institute.
I'm worried. The debt is large. It should be brought under control. The longer we wait, the longer we suffer this kind of paralysis, the longer that Americans are told that, well, this is going to be done through slashing spending rather than raising revenues, the more America boxes itself into a corner and the more America's constructive leadership in the world diminishes.
America is no stranger to debt. In fact, the use of debt to grow the U.S. economy and to bring the joys of consumption to every street has been one of America's great contributions to the prosperity and happiness of the world. American debt has improved lives. Private debt and public debt has been, you could argue, a pillar of greatness, as it has been for Britain at various points of our history. The point is that America borrowed and then repaid what it had borrowed. In the Second World War as well, the total debt rose sharply, but then fell back, and by the time of the Clinton administration, they were seriously considering bringing it down to zero. So what happened? Richard Haass is one of America's most distinguished diplomats, a former head of policy planning at the State Department. He's now president of the Council on Foreign Relations.
What turned things around so dramatically wasn't any single thing, but it was three or four things. One was the tax cuts early on in the Bush presidency. Two, you had year after year after year of a rather remarkable growth in federal government spending. Thirdly, after 9/11, you had a tremendous growth in the national security state, homeland security, intelligence, but even more important, the war in Iraq and, to a lesser extent, the war in Afghanistan. And then lastly, with the economic crisis of 2008, you had the tremendous efforts done by the federal government, begun in the Bush administration, continued in the Obama administration, to stimulate the economy. And all through this, tax rates have stayed essentially low. They were recently extended by this president and this Congress. So you have this continued gap, to put it bluntly, between how much the United States is spending and how much the United States is taking in. And this has been going on for a decade now.
Richard Haass is a debt hawk, but is from the moderate center of American politics. His analysis of how America got to where it is not really in dispute. So why is it so difficult to turn the ship around? Here America's political system comes under the spotlight. Boy, are they proud of it. Americans' love for their Constitution knows no bounds. They revere their founding fathers. They love the idea that American government was set up deliberately to make governing difficult. The president has powers, and so does each House of Congress, and so does the Supreme Court, and so do the states. It's a system that's been called Tudor, modelled on 16th century England, where the king had to do business with the nobles and the church and the inns of court and the merchants. In Tudor England, the argument goes, the monarch had to bring others into any fundamental change. It was a guard against despotism. That is the method chosen by the founding fathers. Jeffrey Sachs, like any proper American, admires what they did, but he has reservations as well.
We have a system that is in many ways, of course, extremely clever and on the whole has been extremely successful, but it was put in place in 1789. And while there have been amendments to the Constitution since then, the basic organization of government has remained unchanged. The fact that we have national elections every 2 years, for example, almost drives the society crazy at this point because it's nonstop, morning till night, every day, end-to-end campaigning. And that means nonstop, every day, fundraising by the politicians. And the moment a November election occurs, the next one gets underway. This is, I would say, a constitutional flaw.
That point about campaigning is hugely important. American political campaigns cost prodigious sums of money. For his re-election bid, Barack Obama alone is seeking to raise $1 billion. Every senator and congressman needs to get as close to that figure as he or she can. It's a staggering amount of money, and it's raised from wealthy folk and from big business, big banks, and the financial industry. Now, what is it that those people don't like? What is the one subject that gets them all going? Tax. Jeffrey Sachs, who approaches the debt issue from the left, sees tax policy as one of the principal reasons why America is in this mess.
We've been through now more than 30 years of a tax-cutting era. Powerful interests, especially wealthy campaign contributors and corporations, continue to have a dominant sway on tax policy. As long as that continues, we're going to have large and chronic budget deficits. So the links actually are that the U.S. does not have a political consensus on how to run a normal government, if I could put it that way. Vested interests play an inordinate role. Expensive campaigns are financed principally by wealthy campaign contributors and large corporations. Those wealthy campaign contributors and large corporations are weighing in to continue to keep their tax rates very low or even to lower them further. And this has become a trap for America.
Sachs's point is that both Democrats and Republicans are ensnared in the low tax trap. Both need funding. Both are in the pockets of the rich. He makes a compelling case. But it doesn't quite explain the extent of the paralysis. During my days reporting for the BBC from America, I became increasingly convinced that there was a wider cultural reason why some of the nation's deepest issues were not being addressed. Americans believe things about themselves that simply are not true. They are deluded, perhaps to a dangerous extent. The writer Anne Applebaum illustrates the point by drawing our attention to one state, Sarah Palin's state.
Alaska is a myth. People who live in Alaska, people who aspire to live in Alaska, imagine that it's the last frontier, it's the place where, you know, rugged individuals go out and dig for oil and shoot caribou and make money the way that people did 100 years ago. In reality, Alaska is the most heavily subsidized state in all of the United States. There are some reasons for that. It's because it's in the far north and it has very difficult infrastructure problems and so on. There's an explanation for it. But it remains, nevertheless, one of the most hypocritical states in the Union for exactly that reason.
And what does that hypocrisy tell us?
The hypocrisy tells us that Alaskans in particular, but Americans in general, often have a very skewed view of themselves. They view themselves as rugged individualists, whereas in practice, their lives are very heavily subsidized in many ways. They have mortgage interest subsidies. Their health care is subsidized in different ways. The oil they purchase has been subsidized in different ways at different levels of government. There are government subsidies all over the economy and often in hidden places that people take advantage of and perfectly happy to exploit, but that means that they're not living as separately from the state and as independently as they imagine.
And this is why the Tea Party has not been quite the force that its members once hoped it might be. The movement took America by storm in recent years with a clear message that spending should be cut. So what's happened? Well, there are strong Tea Party voices in Congress now. They have reached the levers of power. But suddenly, pulling those levers doesn't look quite so easy. The national delusion allows Americans to call for spending cuts and yet depend on spending on the same day. Even the Tea Party, with its clear message and goals, has become caught up in these contradictions. Richard Huss says the whole nation is to blame.
I simply believe that most Americans do not understand the repercussions of the situation we've put ourselves in. The polls show a kind of agreement in principle that something, quote unquote, needs to be done to bring the budget into balance. Americans don't like the fact that they're living way beyond their means, but the support for doing something in principle evaporates when you get down to specifics. Suddenly everyone says, oh, but don't touch my retirement, or don't touch my medical insurance, or don't raise my taxes. So the politicians are feeling at the moment absolutely no pressure to reach a deal.
Added to the political impasse and the cultural myopia, there's a more practical reason why the whole system, the whole of American society, seems unwilling on the spending side to confront the crisis. Anne Applebaum is the newly appointed director of the London-based think tank, the Legatum Institute. As a free marketeer, she says one of the problems with the American system is that it encourages corporations as well as individuals to expect favors from the state.
The presence of lobbyists, of corporate lobbyists in Washington, is an enormous source of spending. The lobbyists for a given industry will have the power to knock on a committee chairman's door. They will be able to call up the person who's writing the piece of legislation. They will be able to discuss their tax interests and their interests in having a subsidy or a tax cut with the person who's writing the subsidy. Because of that, it can be extremely difficult to make cuts.
The system that you just described is incredibly unpopular, isn't it, with Americans? One of the things Barack Obama managed to get through to people with was his dislike of lobbying and his desire, as he put it, to put it back in its box. Why is it that that can't be done?
It's partly that the lobbyists are able to direct money towards political campaigns. It's also that very often, if you are the senator from New York and a very large company that makes something in your district comes to you and says, you know, there's a bill coming through Congress that's important to us, could you look at it? You're going to say yes, because senators and congressmen are responsible to their constituents. In a way, they are part of the democratic process. It's also difficult to stop lobbyists giving money because of free speech laws. You know, we believe that, you know, you have the right to give money to whatever political cause you want to give it to.
Quite interesting, isn't it, that at a very fundamental level, the United States, because of its adherence to freedom of speech and because of the enormous importance that is attached in the United States to certain sort of fundamental principles, that actually then it finds itself hobbled.
Yes, and remember that lobbyists, you know, I don't want to exaggerate their role. They're also lobbyists in the form of environmental groups, which have a lot of power, and they're lobbyists in the form of trade unions. Don't imagine that it's all about, you know, rich guys in smoke-filled rooms with congressmen. I mean, we're also talking about Greenpeace and the World Wildlife Fund. You know, those are big lobbyists in Washington.
But all of them costing money, and that's the point.
And all of them are interested in how law is passed that affects their interests.
Everyone we've heard from so far accepts the basic thesis that America's massive federal debt is a grave problem. They are losing faith as well in America's ability to tackle it. There is one senior figure, though, who is more relaxed. And he is not by any means a spendthrift socialist. In fact, rather the opposite. David Frum is a Republican intellectual and a former speechwriter to George W. Bush.
I don't accept any of this thesis of looming apocalyptic debt. If I tell you that you have a disease that is going to absolutely prostrate you, cause you to lose control over your mind and body, but that it can be prevented by a regimen of taking a couple of aspirin a day and going maybe for a few minutes walk, you say, well, I guess the situation isn't that apocalyptic, is it? The things America needs to do to put its fiscal house in order are not anything like as extreme as the things that have to be done in the countries of Europe. I'm not saying it's not difficult, but let's diagnose the problem correctly. It is a political problem, not a financial problem. The debt is not some arithmetic fact that is the product of gigantic impersonal forces that can't be controlled. The debt situation is a product of political choices and of the inability of the U.S. Congress and American institutions generally to broker better outcomes. But it can be done. People just have to decide they're going to do it.
And here is David Frum's debt cure. It starts with one slash of the surgeon's knife.
The United States spends about 17% of its national income on health care. If it spent the same as the runner-up, Switzerland, 13%, that would be like getting the entire defense budget for free. And there's no reason in the world that the United States can't spend 13% instead of 17%. On the revenue side, the United States has a tax code that is riddled with exemptions and deductions that make no sense on any policy term. The deduction for home mortgage interest, it's completely intellectually unjustifiable. It leads to bad policy results, overinvestment in housing. Canada doesn't have it, Britain doesn't have it, and yet they maintain very high levels of home ownership. You get rid of something like that, you get rid of some of the other deductions in the code, and again, the revenues flow, and the United States would easily be able to balance its books, bring its house in order, and maintain its global position.
Mr. Frum, as befits a former speechwriter, takes a broad-brush approach in which some tricky details, you could suggest, get swept away, not really addressed. How is any of this to be done when nobody shows any sign of being ready to do it? If the Frum plan is to have any chance of success, there has to be a change at the level of the political system. An unclogging has to take place, which would require American politicians to learn once again how to get to like each other and do deals for the good of the nation. Realistic? Anne Applebaum.
Right now, you do not have that kind of fundamental agreement between the two parties. You have the most partisan and the most bitterly divided political system that I can remember in my lifetime. When you have that kind of level of disagreement, it's very, very hard to come to any kind of understanding about the common good.
What do you think reduces the venom then?
The reduction of the venom, it has to come from within the political leadership of both parties. Mm. I think Obama, when he was elected, imagined that that's what he was going to do. Once he came to office, he was almost immediately caught up in Washington infighting, and he was sort of defeated by partisanship. You know, maybe in the next couple of years, he or somebody else will be able to pull both sides back together again.
You're confident he can?
No, I'm not confident. I mean, I'm saying it's possible.
And if it doesn't happen?
If it doesn't happen, we won't reduce the debt, and we'll continue to have this problem.
And America could face a bleak economic future, perhaps a sudden rise in interest rates imposed by international financial markets, a rise that would choke off recovery and make all Americans permanently poorer. But Richard Haass has much wider concerns, concerns that reach out across the globe.
Years ago, Treasury officials would run around the world preaching the so-called Washington Consensus, and the whole idea was telling the rest of the world, be more like us. The virtues of an open economy and the rest. Well, now it's very hard for American officials to run around the world preaching the advantages of what it is we do. But in the long run, I don't think that's good for anyone.
That's a huge, huge issue, isn't it? I mean, if you're suggesting that potentially a debt crisis in the United States could lead to such widespread and fundamental changes in kind of political culture around the world, but that is what you're suggesting, isn't it?
In history, two things matter more than anything else. One is people, the other is ideas. And this is the power of an idea. And if the attractiveness of the idea that has been so central to the trajectory of the United States and, if you will, the West, the United States, Europe, Japan, what have you, but a bias towards free markets and the like. If the appeal of that idea diminishes, then yes, I do think it has tremendous consequences moving forward.
What about the possibility of the United States being, in a sense, blackmailed by the markets, or more to the point, blackmailed by foreign powers who are on the up and who see the vulnerability of the US and who use economic means to crimp the US and stop its ability to use its power? I mean, can you imagine a scenario where that was a reality?
The short answer is yes. And it's ironic that that question would come from someone with your accent, because what it brings to mind is 1956 in Suez, when the United States, the Eisenhower administration, disagreed profoundly with the British-French-Israeli tripartite decision over Suez. And essentially, the United States took advantage of Britain's sterling problem to exercise some economic leverage, if you will, over the British government, and that led to a hasty retreat. So one can imagine a situation nowadays where, say, there was a crisis over Taiwan between the United States and China, which holds a significant number of dollars. And one can imagine the Chinese might be prepared to threaten the dollar or make some comments to weaken it, lest the United States back off some of its support of Taiwan. And in that kind of a scenario, which I think is unlikely but not far-fetched, Chinese central bankers turn out to be a lot more threatening than Chinese admirals.
Worrying words for those who see America as essentially a force for good in the world. The economist Jeffrey Sachs is not always a fan of American power, but he too sees the debt issue in the context of a wider set of questions about America's future and its place in our world. The nation, he says, will have to face up to some uncomfortable truths.
America's economic role in the world will diminish in relative terms in the coming decades. I think this is going to happen with a very, very high likelihood. We are an overstretched society and one that relies excessively on military approaches to global problems. These military approaches are ferociously expensive and highly ineffective. America can get much more for its money through diplomacy and development. I'm hoping that there will be a growing realization of that, not just a retreat behind borders, because you can't really retreat in this world behind borders, but rather a realization that the highly costly way that America has been pursuing its foreign policy makes no sense anyway, and is unaffordable in the future.
On the subject of American decline, you have to be careful. It's been predicted many times in the past, but as with those sects who tell us that the end of the world is coming on a particular day, proof to the contrary eventually causes the Jeremiahs to melt away and pick a new date sometime in the more distant future. America's ability to tackle apparently insurmountable problems, including the debt, should not be underestimated. The author and economist Diane Coyle sounds a note of cautious optimism, though the stress is on the caution.
It's an extraordinary country if you think about the innovative potential, the entrepreneurship. Still, despite everything that's happened, that sense of can-do, that if you want something to happen, you can make it happen. And the personal liberties, the freedoms that people have, it really is a quite extraordinary place. There are also, I think, real signs for optimism in the new technologies themselves. And it's not just that people can use them to innovate and create new companies like Google or Facebook, but also that there's a potential for political and civic innovation in those technologies as well. And I think it's possible that we will see them rooting around the damage of broken political structures, conventional political structures. But on the other hand, there really is a huge economic and financial mess in the States at the moment. And I think my pessimism would be about not only the fiscal deficit, but the banking sector and the absence of any banking sector reform and the capacity of the banks themselves to lobby conventional politics so effectively against any reforms.
It really does come down to the ability of Americans to do what they say they are good at, to seize control of events and mould them to fit their ambitions. But the evidence at the moment is that they are not yet ready. David Frum tells us that there are cuts that can be made now and adjustments to the tax system that would do the trick. But as soon as folks are faced with his or any other concrete plan, it all gets very tricky. And it's not duplicitous politicians to blame here. It's duplicitous electors. A congressional by-election in New York State a few weeks ago saw the Republicans lose a safe seat as a result of a commitment to spend less on Medicare, the health care system for the elderly. Only last year, the Republicans won victories across the country based on the message that government spending had to be cut. But as soon as it got specific, the voters got scared. Richard Haass.
There used to be a saying in American politics that Social Security, the retirement plan, was the so-called third rail of politics, the rail that you would be electrocuted if you ever touched physically in real life or politically. You would lose your job. It seems now that Medicare and the entire medical insurance issue has become the new third rail of American politics. And what just happened in this effectively by-election in upstate New York, I think, will have real consequences. It gives the Democrats a sense that they have an issue they can ride. The Republicans, my hunch, are going to back off what many see as a fairly radical reform of the current way we approach Medicare. But all of it will probably make everybody, Democrat and Republican alike, think twice before they do anything that would be seen as tinkering with this most valued of American entitlements. So in the long run, again, it may well make things more difficult.
You must feel awful, Mr. Haass. Here you are. You can see the train coming. You're there trying to warn everyone and they're just gambling about on the track. They're deaf. They can't hear you.
There's a little bit to that. It was Churchill who said that Americans can be counted on to do the right thing, but only after they've essentially tried everything else. And I think the real issue here is whether Churchill will be proven right. Can we be counted on to do the right thing and put together a new approach to dealing with our deficit and debt before the world essentially does it to us, in which case we have to respond to international financial pressures on truly draconian and at times indiscriminate terms? And we're going to find out whether what Winston Churchill said half a century or so ago still applies at this moment.
It's just a few weeks since Barack Obama stood in Westminster Hall and thrilled many people with his rhetoric and with his ambition. He spoke of the continuing need for Western leadership, the indispensability of that leadership. He did not mention the debt, but it was there, like a ghost, hovering over the president, ready and able to bring him down, to bring down his nation, and to change the course of the world. It need not happen. The crisis is not inevitable. But Americans are facing a challenge as great as any they have ever faced. Speeches will not do. Painful self-analysis, followed by action, is what America faces if the debt is to be tackled. Everything I know about the people and the place suggests to me that Churchill will be proved right. America will, in the end, solve this crisis. There is an almost magical quality to Americans' talent for reinvention, for fresh starts. But this time, they're leaving it a little late.
Analysis was presented by Justin Webb. The producer was Bill Law. If you enjoyed this programme, why not write a review on iTunes or your podcast provider? Next week, Anne McElvoy asks how Scotland's economy and SNP government is coping with the challenges of the downturn.